This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. If you've got a bottle of wine sitting around your house, there's a good chance it's one of the big names, the Chardonnay or a Cabernet, Merlot, Pinot Noir. Those are just a few of the more popular varieties of wine. They dominate the market. A lot of them come from places you've heard of, France, the Italy, maybe California. But in a new book, our next guest dives into the world of wines you don't often hear about and finds a lot of variety, a lot of history, and even some prehistory to wine. Kevin Bigos is a former MIT Knight Science Journalism Fellow. His work has appeared in places like Scientific American, Harper's, and the New York Times. His new book is titled Tasting the Past, The Science of Flavor and the Search for the Origins of Wine. Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thank you for having me.
Well, there's a line running through your book. You started on this quest, kind of, when you encountered this really unique wine in the Middle East. Can you talk about the wine that sparked this book?
Yes, I was in Jordan, of all places, in a just average hotel room, and there was a little bottle from Cremasan Monastery and Winery in Bethlehem. And I didn't know monks, this was 2008, 10 years ago, and I didn't know monks were still making wine in the Middle East, and I'd never heard of Cremasan. So I tried it, and it was a really good, very nice red wine. But I soon found out that you couldn't buy it in America, they had no importers, and I found it very difficult to find information out about it.
And you spent a lot of time tracking this. You found some big international wine experts who didn't even know the story behind this one, right?
Yeah, 10 years ago, even wonderful critics like Jancis Robinson, who wrote the Oxford Companion to Wine, hadn't heard of it. And then slowly people started paying attention, and everyone from scientists to Israeli winemakers to various experts. And it turns out they were using native grapes of the Middle East that may date back, you know, 2,000 years or more, with names like Hamdani and Jandali and Baladi. And that opened up a whole world to me, realizing that there were all these grapes I'd never heard of before.
Right. You write that in the wine industry today, there are some of those big names that people are familiar with, and a lot of wineries rely on those grapes and those kind of wines and just make their own varieties of them. But hidden underneath that, there's this huge, rich variety of local, regional grapes that most of us might never encounter.
Yeah, it's kind of like the equivalent of heirloom vegetables. You know, a lot of people have discovered old tomato varieties or apple varieties and things like that. And I didn't realize until fairly recently that the same thing exists for grapes, just wonderful grapes in almost every corner of the world. Assyrtiko in Greece or Marahefetiko or Himbeerche in Switzerland. And each of them has a unique flavor and a unique story, of course.
Now, if people think of place that makes wine, probably a place like France is the first thing that pops into their head. You dug into some of the history, and actually it goes back before writing the prehistory of wine. As far as we can tell now, where did humans first start intentionally making and drinking what we would call wine?
Pretty much all the experts agree it was in the Caucasus Mountains, which would be the present-day Republic of Georgia or Armenia. And at least 8 or maybe even 10,000 years ago, they have some archaeological evidence from 8,000 years ago, and even some DNA evidence that suggests it was even farther back than that.
And that DNA evidence is a pretty cool new wrinkle on this. I learned in your book that these ancient jars that they used to transfer wine, amphorae, I think they were called, they can, even though these are thousands of years old, they can find traces of the wine that was being shipped in them?
That was astonishing to me. We know now that King Tut was buried with both red and white wine, and we know some of the flavorings the Egyptians used from just the tiny microscopic residues that are left can now be analyzed in things called like mass spectrometers, and with high-tech equipment, they can take one part per billion and sort of reconstruct what the original flavor might have been.
Talking to Kevin Bigos, his new book is called Tasting the Past, The Science and Flavor, The Science of Flavor and the Search for the Origins of Wine. Kevin, are we able to take those ancient wines and make something like them to taste the same something that, I don't know, some Egyptian dude 4,000 years ago might have been drinking and experience the same flavors?
I was surprised to find that in the Republic of Georgia and Armenia, they still make wine in those clay containers. They call them quevri. They're more teardrop shaped than the amphora that the Greeks used. But they've basically been using that same method for 8,000 years, and kind of like the equivalent of unfiltered farm cider. You know how farm stand cider is wonderfully cloudy and full of flavor? They make a whole different type of grape that's like a rustic wine, just exploding with a lot of different flavors.
You also look at some of the science behind wine, and actually humans aren't the only species that has to deal with alcohol, for better or worse. Fruit can ferment in nature too, and a lot of other species have genes that allow them to process alcohol.
Yeah, that I didn't realize it goes so far back genetically that birds and probably even some animals too, you know, had a gene that helped them, you know, metabolize alcohol, you know, perhaps even 50 or 100 million years ago. You know, first things ferment all over the place, and yeast certainly goes back more than 100 million years.
Talk some about the science of how we taste wine, and I'm not a wine expert. I can't tell. I could probably taste, that one's white or that one's red, and that's as far as I could go. Some people are pretty sophisticated, though. Talk about the science of how we taste, how we experience the taste of wine.
Well, the more I look into it, you know, some of it might be obvious is that people have different taste buds, and men and women often have different taste buds. There's some super tasters who are women who, you know, just have more taste buds than other people do. But it also turns out that just things like the music in the background and the lighting and the name on the bottle affect how we taste something. In other words, the scientists say the taste is really happening as much in our mind as it is in our tongue, because our mind says, hey, pay attention to this, don't pay attention to that. So really some of it's mental. And if you tell someone that they're drinking an expensive wine, they'll tend to have a better impression of it than if you tell them they're drinking a cheap wine in a blind tasting.
And even hearing maybe classical music, there have been experiments on that. What we're doing while we drink the wine can also affect our experience of the flavor.
Yeah, there was one tricky one where a supermarket alternated between playing French classical music and German classical music, and they had both types of wine stock, and they found that the background music had people shifting more toward German or French wines, depending on what was playing in the background.
Now, you talk to people who are, you didn't just dig into the prehistory, you talk to people who are currently making wine, and one interesting thing is the idea that, okay, we can take this wine, this grape that makes great wine in, I don't know, southern France, we can plant it here in California, say, and we're going to get the same kind of wine, and it turns out, no, there's a lot more to it.
Yeah, you know, grapes are really native to particular regions, just like, you know, citrus do well in Florida, but not in Maine. And we've tried to make these French grapes grow all over the world, and it kind of works, but, you know, there are all these local varieties that are better suited. And actually, there's some really good research in your region at the University of Minnesota where they're crossbreeding French grapes with Native American wild grapes and coming up with some entirely new varieties.
Now, there's a largely unspoken fear in the wine world about climate change and how that's going to affect their ability to produce the grapes that they rely on to make the wine. What kind of things did you hear?
Well, they're facing some really difficult challenges because, of course, Bordeaux and Burgundy and the Napa Valley are classic regions that, you know, are incredibly valuable. But the climate's already changing where, the Pinot Noir in Burgundy is already moving out of its optimal range of cultivation. So that means what do they do in 20 or 30 or 50 years? Do they move the winery, you know, up to Norway? Doesn't quite have the same cachet. Or do they crossbreed, you know, these famous grapes with, say, a southern grape that has more, or a northern grape that has more cold hardiness or heat hardiness?
Well, another option you write about, and this is probably giving serious wine people headaches just to think about it, synthetic wine, no grapes involved in the creation of the final product. What is out there in the world of science?
Well, you might have guessed that it's coming from kind of the Silicon Valley area where people decided that, hey, you know, wine at its root is, you know, flavors are made up of different chemical elements. So they have manufactured some synthetic wine. It has not been greeted resoundingly by critics. And so far, actually, it's more expensive than the regular stuff. So doesn't look like they're taking over yet, but they're still working on it. And theoretically, yes, you know, in 10 or 20 or 30 years, it might be easier and easier to duplicate particular flavors without having any grapes in it.
Now, you write about the Egyptians, the Romans, the Greeks had gods devoted to wine. You cite Christian and Jewish and Muslim poets in the Middle East writing odes to wine. As you traveled the world, where did you see cultures where wine was just really a central part of their lives?
more than anywhere else, it was the Republic of Georgia, which actually fits into, you know, the scientific theory that the place that's an origin of a particular plant or animal is where you'll see the most varieties. And supposedly they have 200 or 300 or maybe even 500 different grape varieties just in Georgia. And people have grapevines even in cities growing on their roofs and their trellises. And there's still thousands of peasants out in the country who still make their own wine at home in their cellars or in their barns. And, of course, also some very established larger wineries. But it's just everywhere in the Republic of Georgia.
Now, you experienced wine drinking in Georgia. Could we here in Wisconsin, in the United States, do we have an opportunity to try these wines from the birthplace of wine?
Yes, there are more and more good importers who are starting to, you know, import wines from Georgia and Armenia and even the Middle East, the Cremasan wine I tasted. You know, places like Astor Wine and Spirits will ship around the country. And even any good wine store in Wisconsin, you know, would probably be able to order a lot of these wines. There's a free tasting guide on my website that lists a lot of grapes. And, you know, just go to a good wine store or wine bar and ask them if they can find some of these for you.
Is it the same, though, to drink the wine that, you know, the person grew the grapes on their roof or, you know, the peasant out in the country, they grew the grapes, they made the wine? Is there something special to being there drinking it versus getting it out of a bottle?
There is something special to being there about it. And when I looked into that science and, you know, with the background music and all the subliminal things that are happening, I think when we're in a place with a tremendous story, whether it's wine or food or music, some part of us, you know, even expands and comes alive. So there's no substitute for, you know, being in the birthplace of wine, the Republic of Georgia, and drinking it there.
Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Kevin Bigos. He's an author and former science journalist. He joined us to talk about his new book. It's called Tasting the Past, The Science of Flavor and the Search for Origins of Wine.